from Ipanema, chosen to make my guest this morning feel at home, as it's one of his favourites. He was as famous as the Beatles and known as the fifth blonde Beatle, and has even referred to himself as the male Farrah Fawcett Majors of the 60s. He made his name as Russian agent Ilya Kuryakin in The Man from U.N.C.L.E., becoming a pin-up for a generation. And he went on to star in The Invisible Man and Sapphire and Steel, both of which achieved cult status. Retirement doesn't seem to tempt him. For over a decade, he's played Ducky, Dr. Mallard, on the American police drama NCIS, and now he's turned his hand to writing and joins us to talk about his life and his new crime novel, Once Upon a Crooked Man. David McCallum, hello and welcome to the Sunday morning programme.
Good morning. A great pleasure. Most of what you just said is accurate, but there are one or two things that need qualifying.
Oh, well, let's have the qualifications.
When I met my wife, Catherine, I was doing The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and we were not allowed to be out in public because, obviously, I was married at that time to Jill Ireland, and the show was a huge success. And I met Catherine when I came to New York to do a photo shoot for Glamour magazine with Robert Vaughn. And there were two ladies there who were doing the blonde and a brunette. And Catherine was the brunette. And the moment I saw her, something must have happened because we've now known each other for 50 years and I'm married for 49 of them. But when I first went to her apartment in New York, she had a white wicker basket in which was the record player, the gramophone, and she was playing that very soft version of what you just played.
The Girl from Ipanema.
That was the song. That was it.
Oh, well, that's a lovely, lovely story. I'm glad you picked that.
Yes.
David, writing, that must have been a real shift for you, going from other people's words to your own. What prompted you to make the switch?
Well, I went to University College School in Hampstead, in Frognal. And when I was 15, I think it was, I matriculated, that wonderful word.
That's right, I remember
school,
it. Mm-hmm.
School certificate. Mm-hmm. And I got a stamp of approval, and I left. And my father wanted me to go to Paris because I was playing the oboe and play the oboe at the Royal Conservatoire. And Leonard Brain, who was my oboe teacher, thought that was a wonderful idea. I didn't, because by that time I had been working with the BBC, God bless the BBC, mm-hmm. With the BBC Repertory Company, doing children's voices and different accents. I could do different, you know, come on and do a wee Scots boy, mm-hmm. you know, and all that. Mm-hmm. And so I was completely hooked as an actor, and I told my father, I'm going to be an actor. He said, well, then you better just go off and be an actor because we're not supporting you anymore, which was a wonderful thing to say. By then, I suppose I knew I was going to go into national service, and I worked in repertory theatre and other things for many years. Went off to West Africa and was a subaltern in the Royal West African Frontier Force. Came back.
Now, why did you pick that particular regiment, or did they pick you?
Oh, no, they picked me. I was in the gunners in Oswestry, firing 25-pounders for a while.
My God, I was in the gunners in North Wales.
Yeah, I was in Oswestry. Yeah, freezing cold. We probably did guard duty in our greatcoats in the same place.
Goodness me. Yeah.
But that, unfortunately, my math was not very good, and I kept landing the shells on top of our own troops, and so they
not
decided...
Not helpful.
Mm-hmm. So I put him in the infantry. I was commissioned into to several regiments, actually. They were all, by that time, all the postings had taken place for the year. And eventually I was sent out to Accra in what was then the Gold Coast, now Ghana. And oddly enough, my brother Ian, later on, he was the British Council representative in Accra. So we both had a little tour of duty out there in West Africa.
You know, this is ringing all sorts of bells for me. I was secretary to the Bishop of Accra for 2 years in the 50s. I was there when they got independence in 1957.
Yes, well, we were there at the end, towards the end of Kwame Nkrumah.
And who went off a bit.
Well, I had a wonderful captain who was above me in C Company. We mm-hmm. were together for years. And of course we had our sergeant, who was Sergeant Coase, who was known as Bullet, with a huge moustache.
And a
talk
large
about
voice.
Typecasting. Yeah, oh, yes. Yeah. But Captain Lindley said, the history of this place will go like everything else.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be somewhat chaos. They'll imprison the opposition. You know, everything that Kwame Nkrumah actually did, he predicted. Because he said, you have to go through a whole generation, practically, for this kind of change to take place.
Yeah.
But to go right back to the very beginning of all this, being autodidactic and self-taught, about 15 or more years ago, I was reading a book on tape by Jack Higgins, and I thought to myself, I can write this. So I went home, and I took paper to pencil, and I wrote, my hero did this, he did this, he did that, and my first attempts were absolutely pathetic. But I started with the premise of an actor finding $1 million. I was clearly out of work at the time. and so this, in a strange way, became an exercise in teaching myself how to put words on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And to cut a very long story short, a couple of years ago, two or three years ago, I took it out and said, this is ridiculous. Why don't I finish it? And I finished it. A couple of people read it and said, you're crazy. You should do something about this. I've definitely got the bug.
The character, the hero, is an actor, so that's clearly a wee bit of you. They say most first novels are autobiographical. Is there anything else in this about you? I mean, do you secretly go around kind of bumping people off and things like that?
No. There's nothing really in the book about me other than my experiences over the years as an actor. Obviously, you have played. I mean, you have to write about what you know,
mm-hmm.
and then you go off and research what you don't know. But no, Harry and I'm not Harry. I mean, I am Ducky. There's no question of
mm-hmm.
that.
Well, we'll come to that in a minute.
Those two are completely bound together. Yeah. But not Harry.
And are you, when you actually got at it, the writing, were you disciplined? Did you open your computer at 8 o'clock in the morning and write for 4 hours, or did you do it in taxis between bits and pieces? How did you do it?
All of the above.
My
life is busy. I have a family. I have 8 grandchildren. There's a lot of things have to be done in the 2 months that I get home, because I'm 10 months here on the West Coast, and they come and visit, and I'm doing NCIS, and there's always something. So it was a matter of grabbing time. One of the best is I fly between Los Angeles and New York, and you can sit down, open a computer, and you literally have 3 or 4 hours when you can really, you know, edit and do things.
Apart from crime fiction, I mean, you're clearly a reader. I mean, do you have any favorite writers that you follow assiduously? Are you a mainly fiction reader?
Actually, my reading life began back in the 30s. My father was a member of the Detection Club, and we have wonderful pictures in one of the family albums, which I'd love to know where they've gone. He's in white tie and tails and surrounded by all the great authors of that time,
mm-hmm.
Agatha Christie, Edgar Wallace, Freeman Wilcroft. And he just loved what he used to say, I like a good yarn, a good tale.
Yeah.
And so all of the books, and that they had smoking guns on the jacket, on the spine, and they were all on a shelf in the living room up in Hampstead. And I read every single one of them. And we also had the Strand magazine. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but the Strand magazine, which had all of the Sherlock Holmes.
I can remember that. Yes. Yeah. Now, I want to go back to your acting thing and the fact that you're good at accents. Does that actually help you as a writer? I mean, presumably, you're observing all the time. Are you actually clocking other people's style and therefore you're good at replicating it? Is that part of the actor's game, as it were?
No. I think whenever you do an accent, it's because you've heard it somewhere or you've been associated with it. Whenever I'm back in Glasgow and I tell a joke or something, my cousin Deanne says, oh, your accent's terrible.
That sounds pretty good. Actually, that sounded kind of Edinburgh to me. Your accent's terrible.
Yeah, it's no pan loaf.
You're listening to Sunday Morning with me, Richard Holloway, and my guest, the actor David McCallum. David, like me, you're no spring chicken, yet you keep working, acting, and now writing. Now, where does that drive come from? Is it the old Calvinist Protestant work ethic?
Well, that's definitely there. I'm also married to a woman who has brought up in wholly different circumstances, who is exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Catherine is now 72. She's retired 5 years ago, but she's working as hard as she ever does. She's an interior designer and decorator. My son, Peter, is with an advertising agency. He's on a train from Connecticut into New York every morning and back. My daughter has three children. They both actually have three boys. And she is busy trying to establish herself in the food industry with her husband. So we have an incredibly busy family all around. And I suppose as the head of the family, I probably set the pace.
Mm-hmm. And how do you relax?
What's that?
Yeah. So you're one of these workaholic Americans. I mean, do you go on vacation? Do you golf?
I golfed for a very long time. I love golf. Yeah. You know, you don't want the golf to interfere with the walk and all that. Mm-hmm. And I was a weekend golfer to a great extent, and now I'm just a week golfer. Mm-hmm. I play 9 holes. I walk 9 holes with my son, Val. And we have breakfast ahead of time. We're usually through by 11 o'clock. Mm-hmm. We play 9 holes. I can still walk 9 holes in comfort, but I can't hit the ball anymore, you know.
Now, let's talk about Ducky. I understand that you immersed yourself in medical forensics over the years. I mean, why that level of detail? Is it to make you more comfortable acting it? Or would you actually quite like to sneak into an operating room and do the stuff? Tell us about Ducky and the program, because it's an American show, isn't it?
It's very much an American show. When I started, I had no idea what NCIS was, nor did I know anything about pathology. So I went down to the Navy Yard in Washington, where that's where NCIS was in those days. Met the director of NCIS. In the same day, I went to the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology and met the chief medical examiner, who became a very good friend and a mentor. I went to the FBI, to the FBI lab, and actually had dinner that night at the White House with George Bush, and he was having a reunion with several people from Yale, and there was a reason for me to be there. So, you know, all of a sudden, I'm in a whole world that I'd never been in before. Pathology has really been the most exciting for me, because acting, you know, I've done that. I've been doing that since I joined Equity in 1946, so I've been acting a long time. But I knew nothing about pathology and the human body at that level. So to actually witness many, many autopsies and then to gown up and put the masks on and everything and actually be beside the pathologist who was teaching me what he was doing as he was doing it with the technician, was one of the most extraordinary days of my life, the first time that happened. So the human body is so miraculous in the way it's put together and the way it functions. I then, you know, after been playing Ducky for a year, we decided to broaden him a little bit. So we started doing the virtual autopsies and the psychological profiles of people who commit heinous crimes. And that, again, was fascinating. I then, out of curiosity, I took pathology to the cellular level, because they say that death begins with the death of one cell, and then you follow that from there. And that has led me into some very interesting reading and very interesting thoughts.
No wonder you keep going. David, time for some music now. You've chosen Frank Sinatra with One for My Baby and One More for the Road. I love old Blue Eyes. Certainly love the way he kind of caressed the song. Did you know him?
No, I never met Frank.
But you worked with his daughter?
With Nancy, yes. Actually wrote a song for Nancy, and she sang it in her act for quite some time.
And did she talk about him?
Nowadays, when she does her program on the radio and plays her father's songs, you know, it's all in retrospect and lots of memories. Back then, he was alive and kicking and doing beautifully, so there wasn't any need to discuss him. He was her daddy, that's it.
But why this song for you now?
I love autobiographical songs. I love It's Quarter to Three, There's No One in the Place But You and Me. So Set 'Em Up, Joe. I mean, there's a...
Oh, it's wonderful. And the way
element,
he did it.
And the way, and the piano playing of that. Billy Joel does one. It's, you know, there are many, many just simply autobiographical songs that I love.
Well, let's hear this one. I love it too. Sinatra with One for My Baby and One More for the Road. The choice of my guest, the actor and now writer David McCallum. David, can I take you back to Gartahan, a village I know well? I come from Alexandria, just down the road.
Yes. We lived in Rose Cottage.
Is that in the main street?
It's right in the middle of the main street.
Yeah. And did you climb the dumpling?
I did everything, yes. I even learned to ride a bicycle in that main road because there was no traffic in those days.
Yeah. Well, come on, give us some memories. You went to school in Gartahan, and then you went to Stewarton School. Where was that?
Wow, you're really making my mind clicking thousands and thousands of images.
Oh, well, give us some of them.
Well, we were evacuated, you know, sent up to Scotland and my mother came and my brother, so it was the three of us, and we rented this little cottage in Gartahan, turned the backyard into a victory garden with lots and lots and lots of vegetables. That's where I learned to, as a children, you always plant radishes, that's the first thing, and carrots, and watch them grow.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little grocery come post office come everything across the road, where the old folk would sit and scrape little pictures in the dust with their walking sticks. And then I would go to school around the corner up to the little school. And I remember, was that where? No, I do know that she had a knitting needle, and that's what she whacked our fingers if we did anything wrong.
You didn't get the old famous leather belt, the taws?
No, there was no. I can assure you that a knitting needle, a wooden knitting needle across your fingers, I still have one or two joints that don't work as well because of that one. Not that I was that naughty, but obviously I occasionally would fall asleep. And then if you went up the road and turned to the right on our bicycles and rode all the way down to the bottom of the hill, you came to a little beach on Loch Lomond, and my brother's ashes are scattered, actually, on the loch there, simply because of all that times that he and I, we built rafts, we went out on the loch. When we arrived, we would build a fireplace and put totties, and you know, put them on at the bottom and then build the fire over them. And the last thing you did was to pull them out, and they were all black and charred, and put a little butter and salt with them and eat them, you know. Playing games through the fern, you know, the heather and the ferns. You could tunnel through it when you were a little boy, and it became... And underneath, of course, was the moss that was very soft. There was the Clyde Bank raids happened, which was a terrifying thing. The Germans came over to bomb the docks.
Yep.
And I had a skylight above my bed, and I could look up and see the planes coming over. You know, you could see them little dark shadows, and you heard the bombing. And one night, there was one bomber limping his way back to Germany, and he had one bomb that he dropped. And it landed in a farmhouse just up the road behind the cottage. So we all went up there, trooped up to look at the hole that this bomb had made. And down in the foot of it was a dead chicken. And I remember somebody, they were all looking, he said, "Oh, the Germans, they're so terrible." But I mean, looking at this one dead chicken, you know, I can go on and on and on.
I remember the Clyde Bank Blitz too. My father took us out in the street to look at the sky because it was bright red with the flames.
Yes, and I remember going there one morning, and literally you walk down the very centre of the road and the rubble from all the buildings was right down to your feet, Lafont. Yeah. There was nothing there. Yeah. But I do remember, I don't think this was I saw it. I think I probably saw it on a newsreel of Clyde Bank, of the woman cleaning her front doorstep. And there was no house. Mm-hmm. And she turned to the camera and said, "Has anyone seen my bleeding milkman?"
Mm,
you know, gosh. She was looking for a pint of milk.
Yeah.
You could not have driven a milk cart down that road.
Well, Gartahan has hardly changed at all, you know. I mean, if you came back, you'd recognize it.
But I did. I went back.
You're back quite often, are you?
No, once. I took the children, Peter and Sophie. We went over to Scotland on a roots trip, as they call them. And we went to Gartahan, and Rose Cottage was there looking exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
But it was quite frightening because there was a for sale sign on the cottage.
And you weren't tempted.
And I looked at Catherine, and she said, don't even think about it.
You could have had the David McCallum Memorial Cottage there.
Hopefully. No memorials yet. I'm still here.
Still here. Tell us about your parents, both professional musicians.
Yes. My father was born in 1897. And his father actually was born way back, 1835. I mean, my great-grandfather is in 17-something. And father studied music, and he was at the Royal Academy of Music. Let's go back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
His mother gave birth to him when she was somewhat late in life in a little village by the name of Kulsaith.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in one of those little stone cottages in which they lived. And she felt that because she'd managed to give birth to this beautiful young baby, that God had blessed her. And she called him David and tried to find a harp because she thought he maybe could write some more psalms. She couldn't find a harp. She found a fiddle, a little quarter-sized fiddle. And she used to get father up every morning and make him practice before breakfast. Most of his life. The result was when he was extremely young, he went down to England and went to the Royal Academy of Music, and there was a competition. And father was playing a Mozart violin concerto. He was a child prodigy. And he won the competition. And then later on, when I came along, he was the leader of the Scottish Orchestra. Then Sir Henry Wood and Sir Thomas Beecham, then both wanted him to come and lead their orchestras, the London Philharmonic and the Royal Philharmonic. And father chose Beecham and ended up with the London Philharmonic, which he played from 1936 about right through until the war started. And then that was disbanded. After the war, Jack Brymer, the wonderful clarinetist, reformed the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and asked father to come along and be the leader, which he did. So he stayed with Beecham and the Royal Philharmonic right through until Beecham retired. And then father played an awful lot with his friend Mantovani. There's a huge number of records of Mantovani with father playing away, which we still hear on Muzak. My mother, she was born in the mid, about 1906, 1907, and she studied the cello. She played in ladies' orchestras and things. And really, when she married father, she would go down and play in the pit of various theatres in London. She was an orchestral musician that played in the pits of many orchestras. But then basically took care of father, and her career became less and less and hardly at all towards the end.
Let's go back to you. I mean, it's said that you were discovered when a photo of you looking like another James Dean caught the attention of the Rank organization, and they signed you up immediately. Is there any truth in that story?
I was at the Oxford Playhouse with Peter Wood, the wonderful Peter Wood, who I absolutely adored, and with Michael Bryant and a lot of other people. And I met the photographer to all of the undergraduates, whose name was Kenny Parker. And he came to me and he said, have you seen these James Dean fellow? And I said, no. He said, well, I'd like to take a picture of you, with that style, with mm-hmm. that in mind. So I went up against the wall with a leather jacket, a bomber jacket on, and looked sort of sullen and with the right lighting, and he took the picture. That picture went, and Clive Donner saw it, who became wonderful, famous film director. But at that time, he was doing his first film, And he asked me to go along and play the part that I eventually played. But that's how that whole thing happened. And then I did, you know, that at the end of that, they then asked me to become a contract player with Rank, and I did.
And how did you kind of keep your feet in the ground? I mean, you were pretty young, and very often young actors, they kind of lose it a bit, but you clearly didn't.
Well, actually, I still haven't managed to get my feet to the ground. I have had a life, and I've met people, and I always look at my hand and think of all the people that with whom it's shaken over the years. And I think, you know, even with Ducky, there's a Peter Pan element. He has an enthusiasm, an almost boyish enthusiasm. And I think that's something I've never lost. And I think I'm immensely fortunate to have that at the back of my mind. I've added the avoidance of stress to it as I get older. Mm-hmm. So that makes you more and more aware of... You know, it's, what is it in whiskey galore? They say their pleasures are few and simple, and mm-hmm. I try to keep it that way.
Mm. What made you decide to move to America and try your luck there? Because that was a big move too.
Yes.
And what age were you?
It would be 1961.
Yeah.
And I was born in 33, so it would take me at least 10 minutes to do that.
Yeah, you're over 29. Yeah,
yes, yeah, yes. Yeah. It really was the election when there was a... I had been brought up very to the right, shall we say, and when I saw the writing on the wall of the possibility of things, you know, I'm trying to be tactful here, I decided I wanted to go west, young man. I was doing a film called Freud with Montgomery Clift, and I met John Huston was directing, and he introduced me to his agent. And his agent said, yes, they're casting The Greatest Story Ever Told and looking for apostles. And so, you know, eventually I ended up in the United States as a result of all that.
And did you play an apostle?
I played Judas Iscariot.
Ah,
mother said, all your life
he
you play
the best lines.
Well, you play the bad guy, and yeah. My mother said, then you end up with. But then, in studying Judas Iscariot, he was probably one of the more intellectual members of the group. He was also the treasurer.
Yeah, probably the only educated one.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And my theory always was, I talked with Max von Sydow about it. Mm-hmm. That you realize that with any great movement, be it political, religious, or whatever, and there was a tremendous political element to what was going on with the Romans and the occupation, that if you were going to really martyr somebody, it had to be done at the peak. And I think there was a very conscious decision on the behalf of Judas, which was Jesus was completely aware of, that he had to die in order for Christianity to be born, basically. And we talked about all that at the time. Mm. Never talked about it with George Stevens.
Mm-hmm.
George was busy.
Tell us a little bit about Montgomery Clift. I mean, a brilliant actor, but another tragic figure. Did you have much any kind of friendship with him?
I became very friendly with Monty. He actually came over to London and had dinner with us one night, and we spent a lot of time together. He was quite unique and funny and sweet. He was a lovely, lovely man, and I remember very distinctly. I was driving down Santa Monica Boulevard right by the car wash, which isn't there anymore. And I heard over the radio that Monty had died, and I pulled over and I wept.
Mm. I imagine, David, like me, you were brought up in American movies anyway, so America probably always had something of the promised land about it. I mean, I can remember I had an American pen pal when I was a wee boy and used to think, you know, that America was, in a sense, the great country, the West, all of that. Was part of that, was there a kind of a romantic draw as well as looking for work?
No, I think it was more pragmatic. I also was very aware, or at least I was aware once I got here, that there is a misconception about America. I think everything that people who have never been here, all the sort of opinions that they fall about the Americans, you know, is from a consumer society with three cars in the garage and all of the fancy accoutrements of a majorly consumer society. And there was always a very great negativity towards America. I don't think it's gone away in many ways. But at the same time, when you come here and you live here, you realize why these things are and what they really are. And it always saddens me to see that Europe's concept of everything that goes on here is entirely driven by the media. It's not the actual facts. But so I think there's a misconception about this place, which I found when I got here. I just the first time I got here, I rented a car, an open Chevy with a red inside. I think it was a white car, and I drove down Sunset Boulevard playing the Supremes on the radio, and I thought, well, what took me so long?
Mind you, I mean, I've lived in America, worked in America. I mean, it's a big contradictory country. I mean, there's no single America, is there?
No, and if you get on a bus, and people talk about, oh, the Americans, get on a bus going down Fifth Avenue, and you'll hear 12 languages, and they're all Americans. Mm. So that really defies that.
Religion plays a big part in America, including American politics. I mean, a little bit about your own religion. Was religion a strong element of your childhood, your upbringing? Is it still there? Is it still active in you?
When I was a child, and particularly in Scotland and in Kilsyth, when we went to the church, we had our name on the back of the pew. It was the McCallum pew. Mm-hmm. And I was brought up with a, you know, strictly Scottish, straightforward education that included the religious side of things. When I was in the army, I remember when I was in Oswestry, and I met with a priest in the town, and we used to have long discussions about religion because I wasn't sure. I think once upon a time there was a group of people called the skeptics, and I think I fell into that realm to a great extent. Over the years, I've gone back and forth. I have a very strong faith in the fact that we are here, and I have no idea. I mean, every day we find out more about how big the universe is and how about this, that, and the next thing. And I rather subscribe to Richard Feynman. I wish I had it with me, the page where he actually writes that he really is very happy not knowing where we came for, why the universe, you know, the whole who are we, where do we come from, and all that. And he said that he'd rather glorify the fact that he doesn't know than make up stories about why it happened. And I think I subscribe to that. Those thoughts.
And to be glad that you kind of happened as well.
But also to be extremely, you know, the actual practicing religions are, you know, they have, each and every one of them have a way of doing good, the way of helping people. Mm. I mean, all of the ideas of that and all of the ritual, I'm very fond of ritual. I'm very fond of so much of that kind of thing. But at the same time, I would resist proselytizing about the way I feel. Yeah. I think it's very personal.
David, was that an American Hollywood car horn we heard in the back there?
I have no idea.
Yeah,
I'm
we
so
heard
high
it.
Up.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh. Well, there's a car outside, a real authentic horn. We heard it. You're listening to Sunday Morning with me, Richard Holloway, and my guest, the actor David McCallum. David, you've already mentioned your beloved wife. Marriage is hard enough in the normal world, but how have you managed to keep it going? Because it's not traditional in Hollywood to stick to one woman all that time, is it?
Well, they did say in the beginning, oh, it'll never, you know, it won't last, but it has. We're very fortunate in that we're two halves of one unit. We seem to have come together in such a way that everything works. I'm very fortunate. I mean, I've told Catherine that all my life since meeting her, I've looked around to see if I could find anybody that would have been in the same, have the same reaction, and I never have. So we take care of each other. We have marriage by cell phone. I've already talked to Catherine starting at 4 o'clock this morning, at least three or four or five times. I know what she looks like, and I can hear her voice, and I know where she is and what she's doing. And marriage by cell phone isn't all that bad.
Yeah, when I'm away, I text a lot. That's good. David, no life is without its sorrows, even one as successful as yours. So what's helped you weather the storms? I mean, what's your inner compass, as it were?
A belief in a human being and what humans can accomplish as opposed to destroy, I suppose. But the world that I live in and have lived in has been full of mysteries that I've managed to solve, of ideas that I've managed to think about, of people I've met. It is a constant and wonderful, positive way of appreciating the fact that I was born onto this one little planet and have done what I've done. In spite of the fact of how big the universe is, I'm right here doing what I'm doing, talking to you, having written a book, I have NCIS, and it's all happened. Whether I've been instrumental in all of it, I don't know. Obviously, I have to a certain extent. And I don't think it's luck. I always loved the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think about Richard Feynman and the fact that I don't know so much and never will know, and we may never will know. Well, that's all part of the mystery that I just enjoy being a part of the whole thing.
Good man. David, it's been very good to speak to you. Before you go, we'll hear another of your musical choices, and this is the Supremes with Baby Love. Why this one?
Oh, it's all to do with Catherine and I and our relationship and the 60s. I mean, we were both huge fans of all through that time. And this, if you want a romantic song and someone you love, I mean, why not?
Lovely. And thank you for talking to us. And give sunny California a wee kiss from me.
I will indeed. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Bye.